The Timbrook Public Safety Center, which houses the Winchester Police Department, is located at the corner of East Piccadilly Street and East Lane. Across from its East Lane entrance, you can see the northwest corner of Mount Hebron Cemetery. Inside the grounds, there is a beautiful stone wall, which is all that remains of the Lutheran church that was erected in 1793. Just 61 years later, the church was burned, leaving behind the single standing wall. Walking south 150 yards brings you to Mount Hebron's beautiful castle-like entrance, where you walk under an archway that leads you to winding blacktop paths of cemetery grounds that covers 55 acres. The burial grounds of Mount Hebron Cemetery has great history, diversity, and an overwhelming sense of peace. I have often taken walks there in the middle of the day or at the end of a stressful one to gather my thoughts and remind myself just how precious life is. I have visited loved ones and colleagues for reflection and to reminisce. Today, I come to Mount Hebron Cemetery to pay respect to the person that has been the center, the reason for this journey, Lena Robinson. This is DeFrost, Winchester's True Crime with B. Hannon Smith. Before we began this, we had no idea.
Nope.
We had no idea that the city of Winchester had an unsolved homicide.
Well, where it was going to take you.
Never knew the story of Lena Robinson. I know that this for me has definitely changed my life, definitely, for many reasons. I don't know. What has been the most impactful thing to you?
You know, I think it's the number of cases that you work over a career. But then when you pick one up like this and you get to know the people at a different level than just the case,
right?
It's so much more impactful.
Yeah.
And to know all the people in the family and like kind of the reaction to the death, those are things sometimes you don't always get to hear.
So. I think so many of us take things for granted in life.
Oh, absolutely.
You're all guilty of that. And I think that telling Lena's story to the community was extremely important.
Oh, I definitely think so. And you feel like, you know, and sometimes it's not always about the result. It's about the journey to get to the result. And so we know now that we've looked at the case. And there's so much more information that we found out because of this effort that you undertook.
Right.
And I think that's so important.
It is. And I had a conversation with a colleague recently, a former colleague who works for another department. And, you know, when I had this conversation with Caitlin Squires, you know, in her office, I remember talking about this and the plan to end this episode on November 11th, 45 years following her death and where I had hoped to be. You know, I hoped that we were going to be able to, you know, bring this case to a conclusion. And in that conversation that I had with the former colleague, he said, you know, Amanda, these cases are a marathon.
Yes.
You're not going to solve them overnight, and you've got to just exercise extreme patience. And that definitely is not my strong suit. I admit that. But I'm proud of what we have accomplished so far and bringing her story.
For me, I think it's been so impactful, not because of the case and where we wanted to be, but just the things that it makes you consider and appreciate as a person, changing you as a person when you look at these type of cases. So thank you for the opportunity.
I appreciate you being here with me on this journey.
In the past
podcast, I had eagerly prepared each episode, carefully keeping our listeners in touch with what was occurring. It should be understood that this podcast is not a full disclosure of the investigation, because we will not compromise any chance of finding justice for Lena. It was to provide you with a unique opportunity to be alongside us as events and interviews unfolded each month, and to see Craig and I as individuals who care and are dedicated to our community, our profession. Today, as I write and plan this episode just hours before recording, I am anxious, as our listeners have no idea about the significant and impactful turn that our investigation has taken, which began on October 23rd. Detective Cliff Barlow and Officer Caitlin Sloniker left the WPD early that Friday morning for a few-hour trip to Maryland. The purpose? To interview the first person named in the suspect trio by our witness, who now lives in Fort Worth, Texas. We previously referred to him by the alias Tom. Caitlin has joined us in studio today. That's Officer Sloniker, who was with Detective Barlow on this trip. Caitlin, tell us about how that day began.
Well, we left probably about an hour later than we should have left, but that was okay. The drive was really nice, great scenery. We got to the place where we were supposed to be, and the person was not answering the door, so we were unsure what we could do. Finally, after some good knocking, we were able to get an answer at the door, and we spoke to Tom, and we met him in his living room slash kitchen. His house was very nice. It was somewhat brand new building and not a lot of stuff in there, I can tell you that much. We could not sit at the kitchen table. He was taken up by his homemade cigarettes, and his couch looked like he had been camping recently. He had a backpack, you know, sleeping bag, maybe some random clothes here and there. But otherwise, a very nice little house, and we met with Tom.
Yeah, it's actually an apartment building. Am I right in that, or?
So there's a lower level and an upper level, and each one it's essentially an upstairs apartment.
Gotcha.
With a one bedroom, one bathroom, and a kitchen and a living room.
Gotcha. Yeah. Now, you and Cliff had a plan about how this interview was supposed to go down. So tell us about your plan along the way, or what you thought was going to happen and what he thought was going to happen.
So being newer to investigations and very new, rookie, as someone could say.
Although, how many years have you been with us now?
Over six, yeah.
Okay.
So, you know, on the way, I'm super excited. I'm like, all right, Barlow, how are we going to do this? You know, he's like, straight up, good cop, bad cop. And I'm like, okay, so who's going to be the good cop and who's going to be the bad cop? And he's like, no, that's not how we do it, Caitlin. I was totally joking because I was getting excited. I'm like, I can be bad cop. So I'm like, okay, so how does this go? You know, what do we do? You know, I don't want to mess this up. And he's like, you can just sit back and, you know, just sit there. And I'm like, okay. So, you know, do I interject? He's like, no, you don't. So, okay, so what if I feel like you're not asking the right question, or I have a question that I feel is important, you know, to your questions? And he's like, he kind of just did the Barlow shake of his head and didn't really give me an answer. So I didn't really know what was going to happen. And he flat out told me, he said, listen, good investigators don't come up with a plan. You just go with it, and you kind of just let it be free, and you get good stuff from it, hopefully. So we get there.
So real quick, Craig, you know Cliff better than anybody in this room. So does this sound like something he would say?
Yeah, sounds exactly like him.
So we get there, and because there's not a lot of room to sit, we pull out some kitchen chairs. I stand the entire time, awkwardly looking over Barlow and Tom, and taking notes. And Detective Barlow goes into his questioning, and it was a very good interview. And at the end, I'm like, okay. And he ended the interview, and I'm like, okay. So I didn't get to say anything at all. That was great, you know, but I'm just happy to be along with the investigation. And
but,
all
you
that.
Know, sitting back and actually being the person to take notes, you're going to have the opportunity to really observe mannerisms or responses, whereas sometimes the person who's interviewing, they're so in the moment that they don't pick up on those things. So we're going to go ahead and play the recording, or at least parts of the recording, of the interview with Tom. Mm-hmm.
So actually working a case from, like I said, it's a cold case, it's an old case, but new stuff has come forward here recently that we need to come talk to you again. You've been talked to before about this a while back, but this is from a case from 1975. You remember talking to some detectives back then?
It's been a long time ago.
Yeah.
Do you remember what that was concerning?
No.
You don't remember what they talked to you about? Okay, how long were you in Winchester? How long did you live in Winchester?
All my life.
Yeah. Look like you've been there for a while. How long you been up here?
Probably about 4 or 5 years.
So, the detectives had talked to you about a purse snatching during that time. Do you remember talking to them about that? From an elderly lady? So, one of the things we want to talk to you today about, just kind of clear all this up. Like I said, your name keeps coming up and so forth. And a lot of things have changed since 1975, obviously, right?
Right.
So, one of the things we want to do is see if you'd be willing to submit to having just some buccal swabs taken inside your mouth. And
sure.
So, let's go ahead and do that while I'm thinking about it, because I'm an old man. I'll forget in 2 seconds. So, let me put some gloves on real quick, okay? Make sure I don't intertwine anything there, okay?
Right.
Very simple, painless. I'm just going to do some swabs. What I'll do is take 2 Q-tips, run each side of your mouth and under your tongue, okay? It'd be that simple, okay?
Okay.
And we'll give these also to Shalonica if she can hold these for right now. I appreciate it. All right. So, the purse snatching is what it started out as. I don't think what it ended up as was any... was it what was meant to happen. But the lady the purse was snatched from ended up dying as a result of the incident. Okay? Is it starting to ring a bell?
Yeah.
So what do you remember about that?
Yeah, they kept bugging me about that incident. And I didn't, you know, I don't know nothing about all that.
So what happened that night? You left the party. What'd you do after you left the party?
The party.
The party that all of you were there together at night. The house. You may not remember everybody, but these are all people that were involved. And they remember you. So, I mean, it's something that stands out. I know you talked to the police a lot during that time. So tell me what you remember from that particular night. Where'd you go after you left the party? What happened?
I went home, I guess.
You guess? You ever been in trouble with the police before?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? What are some things you've been in trouble for?
Drunken disorder. Trespassing. Quite a few charges.
So, kind of minimize that, huh? Anything else?
No, sir.
Well, I have your criminal history right here, sir. Does robbery sound familiar?
No.
No? Well, yeah. you were convicted of robbery back in 77. We got all kinds of larcenies, maiming. So do you see why this kind of doesn't look really well for you?
I don't see why, you know.
It shows a pattern, doesn't it?
I guess.
What are you going to say when says he saw you down there with at the incident while it was going on? Two of you ran and got into a car, and one ran on down the street southbound. How do you explain that? Because you just admitted you know him, he knows you. So it's not a mistaken identity, correct?
Right.
So, you know, you see how all this keeps coming back?
Yeah.
Doesn't look really well, does it?
No.
This is why I'm here to talk to you to get your side of it. No. You understand that, right? I'm here for you right now. I'm not here for anybody else. I'm not talking to anybody else. I'm talking to you.
No, I never jumped in nobody's car.
No. After the fact, I didn't say you jumped in her car.
Huh?
I didn't say you jumped in her car.
Oh. No. Where was this at?
Okay, so it's more than one time and you're trying to figure out where it's at?
Yeah.
Well, where did you do your other robberies? What area?
Robbery.
Got charges of a robbery on here.
It was shoplifting.
The robbery right here also. I don't want to argue with you. I'm going by what I have right here in front of me.
No.
All right, this is your criminal history.
No.
So this particular incident was downtown near Loudon, Peyton Street.
Right.
You familiar with that area? You've lived there your whole life.
Uh-huh.
So does that ring a bell? Around Christmas time. In fact, she was coming home with some Christmas packages for her grandkids.
Yeah, I remember. I lived right around the corner.
Okay, you lived around the corner. Where'd you live at?
On Loudon Street.
So it's right there near your house, right?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I lived around the house.
So you're familiar where this happened then, correct?
No, I don't remember where it's at.
You just said you lived right around the corner.
Yeah.
Okay, so how do you know you lived around the corner from the incident? Loudon Peyton, what I told you, it's a big area. Could you have maybe been drunk, high? I don't know if you did any drugs in your past. I know you like to drink, and a lot of us do. There's nothing wrong with that.
Right.
Could you have been drinking a lot that night at the party? Maybe doing some drugs? I don't know that part.
Could have been.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Caitlin.
Yes.
So this was one of your first interviews. And as you said, you didn't get to participate a lot or even at all. But did you pick up on things during the interview by watching and observing?
Yes.
What type of things did you notice?
So I noticed Tom's body language. At the beginning, he was just, I feel like he knew what we were going for, but I think that there's more to other crimes that he's possibly committed that he wasn't sure which one we were speaking about. And then whenever Barlow went into the actual evening of the crime, you could see his posture switched. It switched to serious, like, okay, now I know what they're talking about. Yeah, and he was kind of on guard a little bit. And then whenever it came into more questioning, you could tell, as someone referred to it, digging his heels in, he was just like, no, I'm not going to give you anything. No. And he just kind of came nonchalant with his answers. And he was done with the interview at that point. You could tell.
Okay.
So some things that stood out to me in listening, of course, I don't have the observations. I'm just going off of what the recording. So there's a part where Cliff asked him about his criminal history, and he starts to name off things like drunk in public and disorderly and trespassing, larceny. But Caitlin, what did he not say?
He did not say the robbery or maiming
exactly.
or anything violent of the nature that he has definitely been charged with.
Right, that were clearly on his criminal history. So another thing that stood out to me is when Cliff goes into detail about the crime that night, like what the witness said or what the witness saw, and he goes into the specific details, and what Tom does is he doesn't deny it, but he focuses on one small detail and says, his response is, well, I don't remember jumping in anyone's car. So, Craig, we've talked about that a little bit in the past in some other interviews. You want to elaborate on that?
So when you're conducting an interview or an interrogation, first of all, you need to look at it as a process, it's not an end-all be-all. It might be the beginning of establishing a relationship where somebody feels comfortable for you. But there are certain things that you do look for. Number one, typically when somebody's going to tell us a story, it's a balanced story. So you're going to get about a third describing what happened before the incident, a third of the incident, and about a third after. So if at any point in time that gets out of balance, that can sometimes be a red flag that you need to investigate further. And as you said here, at one point Tom seems to be really getting, focusing on the small details.
Right, which, the detail that came at the end of the story, and that was you then jumped into a car and took off, and he says. Now, he could have been the one who fled on foot, because as we found out, he actually tells us that he was living right around the corner from where this happened around the time that this happened.
So he focuses on the one thing
that,
right,
he can
dispute
absolutely.
And be telling the truth, which is, again, it's a red flag. I mean, we're obviously talking to you about a homicide, and you want to argue about whether you were in a car or out of a car.
Right.
So, but as I said, sometimes, you know, the interview is really just a gateway into maybe a process of going back and talking to the person, establishing a rapport, which really, to me, is the most important part of the interview process. People are not going to disclose information to you if they don't feel like they have a connection with you. So that rapport building part can sometimes be the most important part of an interview, and it allows you to come back. So you don't have to view this as an all or one thing.
Right.
You know, it can be a process that goes over time.
Right. And so the part of the interview that that our listeners are hearing is the part where he kind of hits them head on with some of these questions. But what they don't hear is the part that you're talking about at the very end, where he is trying to build a rapport. He talks about not being perfect and puts some of his own personal information there, and then ends it with, you know, I will see you again soon, and leaves his card behind. So he does do that. And, you know, there was another point where he talks about the fact that they all, you know, were drinking and possibly doing drugs at this party. And that could be, you know, a reason behind why this occurred. And, you know, he doesn't really deny that. He actually says it could have been. So even just another clue that we're in the right direction with this. So, and then, Caitlin, you talk about this already, but, you know, the interview goes on for approximately 20 more minutes, and, you know, Cliff just continues to hit him with question after question, and his response time and time again is, I don't know. I don't know. Even when that wouldn't be an appropriate response, but it's like you said, he dug in his heels and he was done with the interview. So, Craig, can you talk about that a little bit too?
Sure. There comes a time in every interview where there's a point at which the person might be done. And, you know, we never know why they're done. Maybe we've hit on something that really strikes them. Maybe they just don't feel comfortable yet. Maybe there's not enough of a rapport built. And so you have to be aware of those things, because it's a balancing act between pushing them and trying to get the information you want, but at the same time not souring the relationship. So it would ruin any chance of coming back and getting more information later. So at this point, based on the descriptions and what Caitlin's saying, is that's where we are.
Right.
We're trying to get our information and we're trying to push it. At the same time, we're also not trying to push it so far that we sour this relationship. And this, we turn this into a dead end when we actually, you know, this is an individual that can provide us with a lot of great information. So we're trying to balance those two things, getting information and not souring a relationship. And so it's, you know, knowing when to do it and how far to push,
right,
is something that I guess you get with practice, and sometimes you never really fully figure out and you're just trying to go based on feel. I'd be interested to see what Caitlin's take on that was. You know, how did you view that portion of the interview?
I felt like we weren't going to get anywhere, and I wanted to redirect a little bit and try to build a rapport then, maybe, just to see, okay, so let's start over, let's take, you know, what we're saying out now, and then build that rapport, and then maybe bring him back to the subject on a lighter, you know, note, rather than just, because I felt like we kind of came in hard and then ended soft, but we should have, I think we could have regrouped, basically, and maybe.
And that's the hard part. I mean, whenever you go into an interview, there's what you plan to do, there's what happens, and then there's the after part where you say, wow, what would I have changed?
Yes.
I definitely think that we got a lot out of the interview, definitely, no question. And there was a moment in the interview that stood out to me the most, and we didn't play that part because it has a curse word in it. But Cliff asked Tom if he knew the woman that was robbed, where she lived, and a few more questions about Lena. And his response is he didn't even know the effing woman. He said, I didn't even know the effing woman. And he like shouts it like that aggressively. And until this point, Tom was being evasive in his answers, but he was never rude or angry. So this brief moment said a lot to me about who Tom was. Cliff was talking about a woman, a grandmother, who had been murdered, and that was his response. Caitlin, you conducted a follow-up interview with a friend of his that backed up this feeling I had of the angry person that Tom could be. But before we get to that, we are going to play a recording of a conversation you had with a retired detective from a major city who now works as an officer in a small town in Maryland. He was responding to a call to check the welfare of someone, which turned out to be our suspect, Tom.
So on Thursday, October 29th, 2020, at about 6:05 p.m., Sergeant Dale Hoffman and myself, we responded to Rogers Tavern. It's at the location of 259 Broad Street. And like I said, Rogers Tavern is an old 1700s tavern that George Washington had stayed in at one point in time and all whenever he crossed the Susquehanna. So in the rear of that, it's located on a small park, and in the rear of that dwelling is a wooden gazebo. So we got a call to that location for check the well-being of an individual, of a white male. When we got there, we approached the gazebo, and what we found was Mr. was seated on the bench in the rear of the gazebo, and he was leaning to on his left side in like a semi-fetal position. He was laying on his left side, on his left shoulder. Both arms were extended partially in front of him. Okay. Underneath of his left arm, we initially didn't see this, but there was a cell phone under his left arm. Okay. Also under his left hand, we saw a half-consumed bottle of cheap vodka. Okay. His feet were on the ground, on the floor of the gazebo. They were facing west. His head was facing a southeast position, and his hands were facing south. If you can envision that.
Yes.
So my sergeant went to wake him up, and immediately upon trying to wake Mr. up, he noticed that Mr. was deceased. He was very cold and stiff and all. I don't know how long he had been there. He was pretty fairly gray when we had a look at him. We immediately called for medics. Fire department showed up. He was pronounced at.
So the ME has the Mr. right now, and they're doing their evaluation.
Yes.
And we haven't heard anything else from them, correct?
We have not. It was, what day was this? This was Thursday into Friday. I was off Friday, Saturday, Sunday. So this is my first day back since his death. So part of all the admin duties I got to do tonight was to contact the ME's office and see if, I would assume they probably did the autopsy on Friday morning. That's what they normally do the following morning.
Okay.
I was going to call down there and see what the outcome was.
Where's his cell phone now? Is it still in your property?
There was actually two cell phones, and okay. I forgot to tell you that other part. So one was under his left arm. There was a second cell phone laying on the floor of the gazebo right behind where he was laying, about, I don't know, foot, foot and a half behind him on the floor. Kind of, he was kind of leaning up against the baluster of the handrail.
Okay.
So we have both phones. Both phones are in evidence locker right now, along with all the other property.
We knew whenever we went there to interview him, he did have two cell phones. One he had his phone number on, and I don't know what he used the other one for, because we found one in the bathroom when we were trying to get his phone number, because he didn't know his own phone number whenever we spoke to him. So I knew that he had two phones that he was using, or at least, you know, he had in his possession. But so I guess, if you don't mind, whenever you hear from the autopsy results, if you could just give us a call.
Detective Barlow was the first to hear the news on October 30th. I had just gotten off work, ready to begin the weekend. In true Cliff fashion, I had suspicion that maybe he was playing a prank. I confronted him on it and told him that this was not something to be joking around about. He said, "No, Amanda, I'm serious. This is serious. Tom was dead." My mind was a whirlwind while trying to process the news. I went for a walk, a long walk. Had the death been intentional? Was it the stress of the interview and the investigation? Or was it none of those things? We are currently working with the Maryland agency to get answers on the death while also following up on our own investigation. This led to the interview, Caitlin, you conducted with Tom's friend. Tell us about who this person is and how this interview came about.
So when Barlow and I got there in Maryland, speaking with Tom, yes, our initial investigation and interview with Tom, there was a man who came about in a car, and he said, "Hey, listen, if Tom's not there, he's probably walking on this path, or he's in the woods and he's, you know, camping out with his buddies." So this guy definitely knew Tom's schedules. He knew his habits. He knew where he would most likely be if he was not answering the door. And he said, you know, "You need to knock harder. And if you knock really hard and he doesn't answer, then he's definitely not there." So I reached out, tried to find this gentleman again after hearing the news of Tom's passing. And I spoke to him on the phone with the help of Maryland's agency there. And he...
So we're going to stop right now, and we're going to go ahead and play that interview.
We were investigating for a homicide that took place in 1975.
Okay.
So when you tell me that gets violent, and you were just previously saying that he...
I thought he might kill somebody.
Yeah, exactly. You thought he might have killed somebody.
That's what I was figuring on. I didn't think he'd be dead. I thought he'd kill somebody. Or, because he just loses his temper, man. I've seen a little guy go off, but I can put him down, but he's just violent. He's the kind you told me before. He goes, "I'll get you with a gun. If that's the way I am, I'll walk up behind you, or I'll stab you." And that's the way he talks, just like I just said it. And I'm like, ugh. If he came after me, because he had threatened me. So what I did was go up to the police and tell them, "Look, if anybody touches my car out here," I said, I'm just letting you know, "that guy down the street there is not too happy with me coming back from West Virginia. He thinks I owe $500, and I don't."
Okay.
But anyways, go back to what you're saying. Like I said, most people, if you ask them, that's what they would probably say, you know. If you know them well enough like I did, then you know, got a short temper.
So this gentleman was a good friend, or actually an acquaintance at this point, but he used to be a friend. He was a roommate with Tom for several years, I believe two, he said. And so he knew him, and that's how he knew his habits. He was not surprised when I told him what we were investigating, which you probably heard. He just was like, "Oh, I figured it was something, you know, I figured he had killed someone." And to me, I was like, holy smokes, okay, this dude... well, he must know Tom pretty well then, and, you know, we're investigating him. He wasn't surprised. That says a lot to me. So we continue to talk, and he says that he was an angry man, and this person is not a big person by any means. I'm a very small person, and he said that, you know, he tried to come at you, and he would, you know, try to be strong with you, and he could, you know, his roommate said that he could get him down, but... You know,
they actually had physical confrontations.
He would try to be physical with his roommate, and he would get into other fights too with the people in the woods. They would fight. You know, they've been robbed before. So he described him not as this person who, you know, is nice and wanting to go out and help someone. He's more of the person who, to be an angry drunk, to want to attack you and is not afraid to start a fight or to finish it, a fight, is what I got from that. He's a very aggressive person, according to his roommate.
Interesting.
This is a habit of his.
While this has been the final episode of the season, this is not a permanent goodbye. Our journey is just beginning. To our families, friends, co-workers, community, we can't thank you enough. The words of encouragement and support Craig, our producer Caitlin, and I have felt are beyond imaginable. The time here was not wasted. Each moment, every tear, all the challenges has brought us here with each of you to bring us closer to justice for Lena Robinson. This has been DeFrost, Winchester's True Crime with B. Hannon Smith.